Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tzadi Yom and Aleph, four lines down. The Gemara is discussing two braitot that we brought at the end of yesterday's daf. One braita said that Avdei Malog Yotzim B'Shein V'Ayin Lisha V'Lo B'Ish, that Avadim Eved Kanani, that is Mechsei Malog, that the woman's injury to the Eved would cause him to go free, but the man's injury to the Eved would not cause the Eved to go free. Whereas we have a Tanya Yidach, we had a second braita that said Lo L'Ish V'Lo L'Isha, not the man, not the woman. And now the Gemara was discussing what is the machloki between these two braitot. The original reason we brought it down was to suggest that takanat usha was the difference between the two braitot. The Gemara in the end says that you don't have to say that, that everybody agrees that we're talking about after takanat usha. And the machloki here is about rava, about whether the shichrur, the freeing of the slave, is able to break the shibud of the other party. The Gemara then says, well, if that's the case, why isn't rava's din a machloki tanaim? The Gemara says, no, everybody holds a Rava. The question here was whether the Rabbanan amunuha l'shibudu debao. Did here the Rabbanan intercede and strengthen the lien of the husband in this situation? And in the normal case, shichrur would suffice to override the shibud. In this case, you would be unable to do that. And that's machloka between the braitot as to whether the husband's shibud is that strong in this case or not. Rather, Tosafot speak here about amuha shibudai the Baal. The Gemara in numerous places, we've seen this in Ketubot a number of times, says that Chazal were Almua, they strengthened the Shibud of a particular individual. He says it's not necessarily consistent. It depends where the Gemara says that it is the case. It's not extrapolable or there's no necessarily logic to it. Others argue the logic is when there's places that it's ripe for abuse, that's where the Chachamim strengthened the Shibud in order to stop or protect against abuses of the system. And here that would be very possible, which is that the husband here who has a shibud, if the wife could ruin that shibud or undermine that shibud, then we want to protect the husband from that happening, and therefore we strengthen his shibud in order to grant him the access or the rights that he is entitled to over here. Now the Gemara moves on to an Ibai Deima, another explanation, which is the Kuli Alma Late Luhu Dahane Tanei Takanat Usha. This machloket here, or this braitot that we were speaking about here, none of them hold of Takanat Usha. It's a little difficult because of the fact that we do paskin like Takanat Usha, and most of the Rishonim believe that Takanat Usha is the halacha. And here the Gemara is setting it up as a case where everybody thinks that there is no Takanat Usha. And they're arguing as to whether Kinyan Perot is Kinyan Aguf, similar to the machloket that we saw yesterday between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan with regards to this matter. Now, the fact that the Gemara uses this is either a possibility of it just a dechia, it's just pushing off or trying to undermine the other possibilities before, but not saying that this is the sole possibility or the right answer over here. Because again, the fact that it says that nobody holds up to Takanat Usha makes it difficult. There are Rishonim for that reason that want to suggest that the Girsa should be otherwise, that it's Kuliyama Itluhu Takanat Usha. Or everybody says Kuliyama, it was pre-Takanat Usha. The Tosva towards the end of the Divya Matka Rabbi Meir speaks about the possibility that when the Gemara over here says that Letluhu Takanat Usha doesn't mean that they don't hold of Takanat Usha, it's just that Takanat Usha is not relevant over here. That they don't need the Takanat Usha, or it's not relevant to these cases, not saying that the Takanat Usha doesn't exist, or it's not the right halacha, but just saying that it's not relevant to our situation, but rather they're focused on a very different issue, which is this issue of Kinyan HaPeirot, Kinyan HaGuf Dami. Whatever the Girsa is, it's clear that the Gemara here is trying to show that you can't force the Machloket in any single direction. We've already tried three different possibilities of how to set up the Machloket in the Braitot, and none of them is absolute or foolproof. And for that reason, since you can suggest any one of them, it means that since all of them are possibly true, that means that none of them can compel us to say anything here. The Gemara says, Uplukta Dahane Tanei. And this Machloket Tanaim between these two braitot would be similar to another Machloket Tanaim that we have, as to whether Kinyan HaPeirot, meaning that the leasehold or the right of usage that the husband has here, is that considered to be Kinyan HaGuf? If that's the case, then the husband has almost equal rights with the woman, and he could block her selling the item. On the other hand, if it is the other way around, that Kinyan Perot is Lavki Kinyan Guf Nami, that means that the woman's rights are still there and strong enough in terms of her ownership for her to do something with the slave. In this instance, it would mean that it's strong enough in order to free the slave and cause that to breach the lien of the husband, and that's why the Eved would go free if the woman knocks out the Shein or the Ayin of the Eved. Tanya, Mocher Abdullah Acher, someone who sells his slave to someone else, Upasakimo Amanach Ishamshenu Shloshim Yom. But it's a delayed sale. He says that I want him to keep him to work for me for the remaining 30 days. In essence, he sold it to him. And then the party that bought it is leasing him back or giving him back to the original owner for use for 30 days. Now, Rabbi Meomer, Rishon Yeshno Bedin Yom Yomayim, Bnei Shu Tachtav, Kasavar Kinyan Perot, Kikinyan Gufdomi. Rabbi Meir says that the original owner here has the special din of Yom Yomayim. Yom Yomayim is a din that is written by Eved Knani, and that is when the Eved Knani is injured, then it says there that if he gets up, meaning that he is healthy, he walks on his feet for Yom Yomayim, the Pasuk Mishpatim says, in Perek Chafal Pasuk Chavichia, Ke Ish Et Avdo Et O Et Amato B'Shevet, V'Meit, Tachat Yado Nakom Yinakim. If a master kills the Eved Knani, he is responsible. He is subject to a death penalty as if he killed any other individual, any other Jew. Ach, this is the exception. It's a special Gzer HaTub. Im Yom O Yomayim Yamod, if the Eved Knani gets up for a day or two, O Yakum Ki Kaspohu, he will not be subject to the death penalty because he is his possession. It's a special, unique exemption for the owner of an Eved Knani that not if the Eved Knani dies from the blow or from whatever activity the master engaged in, the master is chayav mita, like anybody else who kills any other individual or human being. The only exception is if the Eved Knani survived the blow and actually got back up. And for a day or two, he looks totally fine. Or he, after the blow, is walking around for a day or two and looks totally fine, and then only later falls ill. Even though you might be able to correlate or connect it to the original blow, there's a special exemption for the owner that says that he is not subject to the death penalty in that case. And so what we're discussing here amongst the Tanaim is who is deemed to be the owner of the Eved Knani during this period. It's a Gzeirat HaKetuv by Eved Knani, that if the Eved Knani is able to get up for a day or two and it seems healthy, then even afterwards he falls back into the illness or his health degrades after that, then the individual who killed the Eved would not be held accountable, meaning we're not subject to the death penalty. But that's only true of the owner of an Eved Kenani. The special din or special rule with regards to the relationship between an owner and an Eved Kenani. So now, what Rabbi Meir says is, who is deemed to be the owner of the Eved Kenani during this 30-day period? And he says that it's the Rishon. The seller is the one who's deemed to be the owner of the Eved Knani during this period of time, because the seller is the one who has the leasehold in the Eved. He's the one who's able to utilize the Eved during this period. And as the Gemara tells us, that means the Remeir holds that Kinyan HaPeirot Ki Kinyan HaGuf Dami, that Kinyan and the Peirot, his ability to use the Eved and his output for that 30 days, makes it as if he is the owner of the Eved. And since the owner of the Eved, he is the one who has the din of Yom Yomayim or that Gzera Takadu. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, Sheni Yeshno B'din Yom Yomayim. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, it's the second person, meaning the buyer, that has the rule as the owner of this Eved Knani and has the rule of Gzera Takadu of Yom Yomayim. Mipnei, Kishu Kaspo. He's the owner. He's the real owner of this Eved Knani. He's just lending him back or he's leasing him back to the original owner. Kasavar, it's clear that Rabbi Yehuda holds Perot, Kinyan Perot, Lav Kikinyan Aguf Dami. That the first individual who now has the rights to utilize the Eved for that period of time does not have real ownership in the Eved, and that is based on the fact that Kinyan HaPerot is Lav Kikinyan HaGuf Dami. There's a special Gzeirat HaKetuv by an Eved Knani that if you are the owner, that if the Eved Knani gets up for Yom Yomayim, then you're exempt from the death penalty. That only applies to the owner. So Rabbi Meir says the owner is the person who has the rights to utilize the Eved during that 30-day period. Rabbi Yehuda says the owner of the Eved is the real owner of the Eved, the one who purchased the Eved now. Even though the first guy is still using him, the second guy is the owner of the Eved, and he's the one who gets that Gzeirat HaKetuv. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shnehem Yeshnam B'din Yom or Yomayim. Rabbi Yossi says they both have a din of ownership here. Zemipnei Shehu Tachtav. This one, meaning the first one, because he's working for him right now. Zemipnei Shehu Kaspo. And the second one, because he is the rightful owner of the Eved now. He's the one who monetarily owns the Eved. Misveikale, he has a safek, kinyan perot, iki kinyan aguf dami. He doesn't know whether it is or isn't, and therefore, misafek nefashot dakel. We go to kula, because we're dealing with the death penalty. To deal with the death penalty, we're going to go to kula in terms of saying that this person's a murderer. So therefore, in both cases, whether it's the first guy or the second guy, Rabbi Yossi believes during that 30-day period, they're both deemed to be the owners, because I'm not sure which one I should consider the owner, because one of them has the utilization rights there, and if you believe Kinyan HaPerot Kinyan HaGuf Dami, that's enough, he would be the owner. The other one has the ownership, the monetary rights in the Eved, And if you hold kinyan peirot lav kinyan guf tami, then the only owner here is the second individual. Since I have a safek, both of them are granted that exemption, or they don't get the death penalty if you get up yom yomayim, because they are both deemed misafek to be owners of this eved kenani. And therefore, according to Rabbi Yossi, it's safek nefashot dakel. If you say safek nefashot dakel, that means neither party are we going to deem to be subject to the death penalty, because we'll say both of them could possibly be the owner of this eved kenani. Rabbi Leizer omer shnehem einon bidin yom o yomayim. Neither of them have a right to be considered the owner here. Zeh lefi she'enu tachtav, v'zeh lefi she'enu kaspo. This one, because he's not under his jurisdiction. Number two, that is, the buyer of the Eved Kenani, who now lent it back or leased it back to the original owner, he's not in his possession, not under his jurisdiction. V'zeh lefi she'enu kaspo. And the original owner, who's now sold it out and is just utilizing the Eved, he doesn't own the Eved. So both of them have a failure in their ability to be the owner or the master of this Eved Kenani. And that failure makes it that neither of them are granted that special exemption of the Pasuk. So this is reminiscent of Rabbi Yochanan with regards to Hekdesh, when we dealt with the Ganav, where it says that neither party can be Makdisha, not the Baal and not the Ganav. The Baal can't be Makdisha because it's not with him, Eno Bershuto. And the Ganav can't be Makdisha because it's Eno Shalom, it's not his. So the same idea over here, which is that neither of them really own this Eved Kenani. So Amarava, my time with Rabbi Eliezer, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Eliezer's position that neither of them really own the Eved Kenani? Amarkra, ki kaspohu, that was the final words that we read in the Pasuk before, it's ki kaspohu, it's under his ownership, kaspoham yuchado, it has to be his unique and total ownership of the Eved Kenani for him to be granted this exemption. Otherwise, that is not the case, or otherwise you don't get that exemption. And over here, neither of the parties has sufficient ownership to be granted that exemption. Kemanaz lahad da amara meimar. According to which Tana is this statement of a meimar made? Ish v'isha shemachru b'nechsei melog. A man and a woman who sold the mechsei melog. Lo asu v'lo klum. They did nothing. They accomplished absolutely nothing with their sale. Keman, who's that like? Rabbi Eliezer. It is similar to this position of Rabbi Eliezer, that neither party has full ownership over here. Remember that when it comes to Nechsei Melog, the woman has the underlying ownership of the property. The husband owns the leasehold or the production rights of the property. So each of them owns similar rights that we just discussed as to what is true by the Eved Kenani. One of them owns the actual item, but lacks the jurisdiction or the ability to utilize it. The other one has utilization rights, but doesn't own the underlying property. That's true by Nechsei Melog, just like it's true by this case of the Eved Kenani, or the scenario that we had in the Braita. As Rashi notes over here, this lo asav v'lo klum, if you look in Rashi, it's very important. Rashi says, she'enu lo lezeh v'lo lezeh. Neither of them own the nechsei melog. Vim meitech chad mehem. If one of them passes away, zeh nish'ar motzi mideh lekuchot. The other one will have the right to take it back from the buyers, because the buyers didn't have a right to buy it from either party. Neither party had the right to sell it. They weren't sufficient owners to sell it. Velo domo l'shutafim da'alma. This is not like a regular type of partnership. Dehatam yesh lezeh chelek b'kulo, lito chetzi, chenz lezeh. That in a normal partnership, each one of them owns 50% of the whole. They both have the same type of ownership, or joint ownership there. And that joint ownership grants them the same rights and the same ownership, and they own 50% of that same ownership. Avahacha over here, it's very different. Kulan knuim la leguf, kulan knuim lo leperot. They don't own a shared 50%. It's not like they own 50% of 100% of the Eved or the Nechsei Melog, and the other party owns 50% of the 100% of the Nechsei Melog. Rather, in our case here, you own your 50% of ownership, which has nothing to do with the other party's 50% of ownership, because they're different forms of ownership. One owns the actual monetary rights, one owns the production rights. And therefore it says, Avahacha kulan kulim la leguf, kulan kulim la leperot, v'lechem yuchad lo lezeh v'lo lezeh. Neither of them has sufficient or unique ownership, unique enough solid ownership over here. So as Rashi points out, this is very similar to what the Ran says in the Darim when he deals with the Perek HaShutafim, and tries to differentiate between which cases we do say Breira and which cases we don't say Breira to reconcile the Psak over there. It says that sometimes there are two types or two forms of partnerships that can exist. There are partnerships that exist where we both own 100% of the item. It's just that I have 50% of that 100% and you have a 50% of that 100%. There are third types of partnerships where we each own 50% of the item. And that's it. I own 100% of my 50%, but I don't own 50% of the 100%. And that's a difference in formulation. Over here, I own 100% of my 50%, and you own 100% of your 50%. You own the goof, I own the payroll. And so there's no overlap between us. Each of us owns 100% of our 50% of whatever is here. But that means that there's no shared ownership. There's never any complete ownership by any individual party. On the other hand, if you formulate it that the shutafut or the partnership exists in this manner, which is we each own 50% of the 100%, that's a different form of partnership. There's a possibility of each partner having sufficient ownership to be considered an owner of the item in that case, because my 50% relates to the whole or to the totality of the 100% that is there. And so for that reason, neither party has sufficient rights to sell over here, and that it's not that we say here that one party has it and one doesn't, but rather neither party has it. And Tosafot goes as far as to say is that even if both parties sell it, even if the husband and the wife sell it, there's no sale that goes on here by Nechzei Malok. Now, how far you take that statement of Tosafot isn't clear. The Ravid, I think, in speaking about the Shita of Tosafot over here, suggests that that is only true if they both didn't sell to the same party, or they didn't sell at the same time. That means if they independently each sell to Nechzei Malok, the sale still doesn't go through. But if they jointly got together and agreed to sell to a single person, then possibly the sale would go through, because then the total rights together have been pooled and then sold out. But from the Baal Tosafot, you can conclude that neither party has the rights, and even together they don't have a right to sell it, because neither party has sufficient ownership to sell over here. And so even though they can sell their 50%, that 50% sale is not a valid sale. And so neither party can create a sale that is sufficient enough to join together to create a complete sale of the Eved. That's what Tosafot says over here. Eved Malog, Dein Miuchad Shneem, Shlezei Yesh Pirov, Lezei Yesh Guf, Vein Zeh Karui Balim, Vafilu Shneem Yachad, Einam Yecholim L'Mochro, Mokein, Ein Yecholim L'Shachoro. Both of them together can't sell it, and both of them together can't free the Eved. Neither of them are classified as the Balim over here. And therefore, Tosafot comes to the conclusion that we noted before, which is, Hilkach, L'Shayach Halibid Rabbi Elezer Klau Takanat Usha. Takanat Usha is not relevant over here. It's not meaningful. Rabbi Elezer says that the failure to allow for the sale to go through has nothing to do with Takanat Usha. You don't need Takanat Usha over here. The failure is in the original ownership, or the way that the ownership is divided. The nature of the way that the ownership is divided precludes the ability to have a sale here, or basically precludes the ability to have balut, ownership over the item that is sufficiently strong to sell. And even without Takanat Usha, you don't have it. And that's what the Baal Tosafot, as we quoted before, has suggested, that when the Gemara says that nobody here has Takanat Usha, doesn't mean that they don't hold of Takanat Usha. It just means it's not relevant in this scenario, or it's not relevant to them in the case of Nechzei Malok. The real question then is, what does Rabbi Meir do with the two braitot that we saw before? Because those braitot say either the Isha, the woman, is empowered to be the owner of the Eved Knani, or neither of them are empowered to be the owner of the Eved Knani. Whereas according to Rabbi Meir, you would have thought that at least the husband has equal rights to the woman to be empowered as the owner of the Eved Knani, because he has kinyan peirot kinyan aguf domi. So how do we reconcile Rabbi Meir with those braitot? Those notes that avagav begabi shem ayin en yotzeh lo leish lo isha mishum dein lo koach l'shachrer kinyan aguf shal isha aval bedin yomo yomayim shu tachtav v'yesh lo koach lirdoto lasot melachto svaruhu shi abidin yom yomayim ma'achar de kinyan peirot kinyan aguf domi. So what Tosafot says is that we are going to bifurcate the dinim, and with regards to the din of Yom Yomayim, we can establish ownership or balut, or being the adon over here, in order to exempt the owner if he dies after being around for Yom Yomayim. On the other hand, in the case of Shein Ba'ayin, because of the kinyan aguf of the isha, that will block the ability of the man to free the slave if he knocks out the Shein or the Ayin. So the dinim will be different, that by Shein Ba'ayin, knocking out the eye by the husband will have no meaning and will not be sufficient to free the slave. On the other hand, when it comes to the din of Yom Yomayim, the Gzeirat HaKetuv, that the owner, if the slave walks away for a day or two and then only passes away after that from the blow, that they are exempt from the death penalty, that he will have a right to. according to Rabbi Meir. Although Rabbeinu Yitzchak Bar Baruch Mefarish the Rabbi Meir Nami Yotzei B'Shein B'Ayin Leish, he says that then according to Shita Rabbi Meir, then there would be a third Braita in essence that says that B'Shein B'Ayin, both the wife and the husband have the ability when they knock out the chain in the eye to free the slave because he holds that Kinyan Perot Kinyan Aguftami. And that is the two Braita that we saw before. One Braita would follow Shita of Rabbi Yehuda, who holds that Kinyan Perot Kalav Kinyan Aguftami. And the other Braita that says neither of them have the right will be the Shita of Rabbi Eliezer. And we would have a third Braita, which would be Shita Rabbi Meir, where Nami Yotzei B'Shein B'Ayin Le'ish. Not only would he go out with the Shein Ayin of the Isha, but also with the Shein Ayin of the Ish. That's according to the Rabbi Yitzchak Ber Rabbi Baruch in the Balei Tosafot. Or you go with the original Shita of the Balei Tosafot, which is that the Dinim of Shein B'Ayin are separate from the Dinim of Yom and Yomayim. And even though Rabbi Meir thinks that Kinyan Perot Kinyan Aguf is sufficient by the din of Yom Yomayim, he does not think it's sufficient by the case of Shein V'Ayin. Where it says, Mantana had the Tarubanan, who's the author of the position that is found in this Braita? Mi shechetzio Eved v'chetzio Ben Chorin, person who is half a Ben Chorin and half an Eved Knani, v'chen Eved shel shnei shutafin, or an Eved that belongs to two partners, en yotzim b'roshei avarim. They do not go free if one of their primary avarim, shenan chozrim, which is not repairable, is something that does not return, is knocked out, then they do not go free. So Amar Rav Mordechai the Ravashi, Achi Amra Mishmei de Rava, this is what they say in the name of Rava, the Rabbi Eliezer, it's Rabbi Eliezer. Milo Amar Rabbi Eliezer Kaspo Amyuchad Lo. Didn't Rabbi Eliezer say before with regards to determining whether someone has ownership over an Eved Kani or Balut over an Eved Kani, it has to be Kaspo Amyuchad Lo, it has to be something that is uniquely and completely owned by this individual. Hacha Nami Abdo Amyuchad Lo. And here, in order to go free, based on the Roshei Evarim, you would have to be Abdo HaMiyuchad Lo. In order to be deemed the owner of the item, it would have to be the fact that it is his Eved, or uniquely his Eved, in order to go free, based on the Sukkim that tell us that if one knocks out the eye or the Shein of the Eved, that that would grant him freedom. Over there it says, so there the term abdo is used, similar to the way that kaspo was used by the case of the death penalty. And so if you extrapolate this din of Rabbi Eliezer, that would mean that abdo means abdo miyuchado. He has to have unique and sole ownership over the Eved. And that is not the case by chetzio Eved v'chetzio ben chorin. It's obviously not the case by shnei shutafim. Now, the Tosfot over here suggests, when we said over here that it means Eved shel shnei shutafim, shelezeh aguf v'lezeh aperot, that means that one of them has the guf and one of them has the perot. Based on what we just learned now from Rashi, that the shutafut here is different than a normal partnership that we would see anywhere else in Shas. That anywhere else in Shas, this partnership is literally a 50% ownership of the 100%. Over there, it seems from Rashi that if that was the scenario, then you would be deemed to be the owner of the Eved Kanani. And if that person then killed the Eved Kanani and he stayed around for Yom Yomayim first, that you would be Pator. And same here by the Makev Eshein and Ayin, he should go free based on that. So Tosfot says, if I extrapolate Rashi to the remainder of the Gemara here, that would mean that when we speak about a Shutafut over here, this is not a regular partnership that we're speaking about. Rather, we're speaking about a partnership that is similar to Nechzei Malog. That partnership is that one person owns the Guf and one person owns the Perot. And he says you have to say the same thing by Chetzio Eved and Chetzio Ben Chorim. Nami. It has to be a case where he was Shnatan Kol Damav. He already got his whole money paid out. Venu Mukava to get Shichru Liot Mutar Bat Chorim. It's not your classic case of Chetzio Eved and Chetzio Ben Chorim. The classic case there is we have two partners that own the Eved Kanani. One of them freed him, the other one did not free him. So that's how you have a Chetzio Eved and Chetzio Ben Chorim. Tosfot says that's not the case over here. The case over here is where he's completely free. The only problem is that we're missing the Get Shichrur. So since you're missing the Get Shichrur, and therefore since this Eved Kanani doesn't have full ownership over himself, but the owners of the Eved Kanani also don't have full ownership over him, they're each missing an aspect of it. So in that case, you can't be deemed to be the master of the Eved. Since you can't be deemed to the master of the Eved, you're not going to be chayab to free the slave if you knock out a Shein or Ayin, and you will not be granted the exemption of Yom or Yomayim. And the same is true of an Eved of Shnei Shutafim. It's not your classic, a regular case of partners that own the Eved, but rather, they're talking about here are partners that own the Eved in different ways. One owns the leasehold and one owns the ownership rights in the Eved. similar to the case of Nechsei Malog. And that's why in these two cases, we said that they are not deemed to be the owners because there's a failure in their totality of their ownership, something that's missing. In one case, it's either he owns the monetary rights or he owns the production rights, one or the other. And the second case, it's the fact that the monetary rights have been given to the Eved himself already. He was paid his way out. But the Get Shechrur, it's still in the hands of the original owners. And so they have not freed him with the Get Shechrur. So they have the Iser ownership over him. He has the monetary ownership over him. Again, there is a tension in the ownership, which makes it that no single person is considered to be the Balim of this Eved Kanani. That's the question. When you have the leasehold, are you the halachic owner during that period of time? Clear that it's going to be suspended or it's going to be terminated once you lose the leasehold. There's no question about that, that will go away. If Kinyan HaPirot is deemed to be as if you have ownership on there, then anybody who is in the property during that period of the Ovel is considered to be the owner for that 50-year period, and he can bring the Bikurim, and he can say the Mikurim during that 50-year period. Tosfot over here discusses a big problem with this, which is that if you really hold like Rish Lakish, the one that says Kinyan Pirot, Galav, Kinyan Aguf Dami, Shmuel passes like Rish Lakish, that Kinyan Pirot, Galav, Kinyan Aguf Dami, and he passes like Rabbi Yochanan and Achim Shechuku are considered to be Lekuchot. When brothers divide up the estate, they're like buyers, that you could have never have anybody who brings Bikurim and says the Parsha Bikurim, because nobody really owns the property that they live on. Everybody who's on their property has a leasehold on the property, because when you divide up the Yerusha, it's really like we're buying from each other, and every Yovel you have to bring it back and redivide it again. And that means all you have in there is a leasehold to utilize it during that period of the 50 years of the Yovel. If that's the case, you're not the owner of the land, you're not the owner of the land, you can't come and say Mikra Bikurim. So that's a Tosfot, and the Rishonim deal with that issue with regards to if you really think that a Kinyan HaPirot is Lavka Kinyan HaGuf Dami, you really run yourself into problems in certain halachot, like that of Bikurim. All right, the Mishnah says, Tokeya lichavero notein lo sela. Person who, Tokeya, normally you would think of Tokeya as like blowing a shofar, but over here, he does something that injures the individual, but it seems that the primary problem here is not necessarily the injury, but the embarrassment caused by what he has done. Rashi gives two explanations as to what Tokeya is. Tokeya lichavero zikoelos no. One possibility is that he smacked him on his ear. Lashon Mori, that's what my Rebbe told me. Lishna Achrina is Tokeya Mamash, that he literally blew a shofar in his ear. Those are the two possibilities brought by Rashi. The Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot says, Tokeya Levechaveroz hu mishimake chavero bepas yodo sagur ba'arpo. It's a case where he takes his closed or clenched fist, it seems like, and punches the individual in the back of their neck, or the side of their neck. So these are different explanations as to what it means to be Tokeya lechavero. The last possibility was brought earlier in the Masechta, which when we spoke about this issue earlier on, back on Daf Lamed Vav, we come over there, also we brought from the Rishonim that a Tokeya lechavero is someone who claps his hands next to someone's ear. That he smashes his hands together right next to the ear and causes them to jump or to be frightened. So in that case, noten lo sela, he has to pay him a sela. The Rashi over here says that noten lo sela mishum boshet, that is solely for the payment of the embarrassment over here. The remainder of the chamishat dvarim are not incorporated or encompassed by this payment that is made over here. And you would have to then assess those separately. Rambam, the Perush HaMishnayot, says that the payments that we have here are all inclusive. Perush Elo Shurim and Iskrim heim tachlit mashutein ladam chashuv. This is the complete amount of what you pay to these individuals, meaning that this amount incorporates the chamisha dvarim. The main reason being that the majority of the value is the boshet. The nezek and the tsar are going to be very little of these payments, and therefore the knas that was imposed with the chachamim incorporated all of the chamisha dvarim. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mishum Reusik Lili, maneh. He pays them 100. Staro, noten lo matayim zus. If he slaps him across the face, he pays him 200 zus. La'achar yado, if he slaps him with the back of his hand across the face, noten lo 400 zus. He pays him 400 zus. Tzaram bi'ozno. If he does something to his ear, again here, Rashi brings the possibility is mashach, that he pulled on his ear. Ubebrachorot, shamati lashon pugem. Rashi over here is noting from the Mishnayot in Bechorot. Mishnayot in Bechorot says that a person who wants to put a mum into a Bechor, he's Tzoreim Ozen Bechoro. He goes in and cuts, or he makes an injury in the cartilage of the ear of the Bechor. So what Rashi is referencing is that the explanation in the Mishnah in Bechorot. Rashi brings again two explanations here. One possibility is Mashach, that he pulled on the ear. The other possibility is that he actually cut, it seems to be, or he did something that injured the ear. The Rambam in the Pesach Mishnayot writes, Taram Bil Zno, Shepasal Zno, Vehika Bo Kein Akitza. And he hit it like some sort of Oketz, which means like a thorn or cut, that he tore it in some way. So that's the way the Rambam in the Pesach Mishnayot explains that it's some sort of tear or ripping of the ear. Rashi says one possibility of pulling of the ear, or the other one that he causes some sort of injury to the ear. So there, Talash Bisaro, again, he pulls his hair out, Rakak, he spits at him, and he gia baroko, and the spit, the actual spittle hits him. Hevir Talitomimen, he pulls his cloak off of him, Parah Rosh Aisha, he uncovers the hair of a woman, Bashuk, in the public marketplace, Notenlo Arba Meo Tzuz. In all these cases, you pay 400 tzuz. This seems to be the maximum fine that is levied on these people. And again, these seem to be the most embarrassing or the things with the most affront towards the other party. And therefore, these are the maximum penalties. All of these penalties are midrabanan. These are knasot. None of this is midoraita. It's a payment table or fine table established by the chachamim for these types of embarrassment. Ze haklau. This is the principle called the fi kvodo. Everything is based on the standing or stature of the individual. Now, that could be a statement, the kula or the chumra. Does that mean these are the maximum penalties? And then, a kol defi kvodo means if it's lesser than that, then you would reduce the penalties. Or are these the minimum penalties? And if someone was of a higher stature, you would pay more than that? The Gemara will discuss that. Amar Rabbi Akiva, afilu aniyim shib Yisrael. When it comes even to the poor people of Yisrael, rolim otam kiluhem b'nei chorin, shiardu mi'chseyem. They're considered to be like free people. Yeah, they lost their money, but they still were of a higher stature. Shem b'nei Avraham, Yitzchak v'Yaakov. Rabbi Akiva argues for equality, meaning that boshet should be something that is objectively established, and that there should be no differentiation between people. U'maisa b'echad, shepara rosh ha'isha b'shuk. And there was an incident like this, and you can see Rabbi Akiva pasting like his shita, which is this individual pulled off the covering of a woman's hair in the shuk. Bat lifnei Rabbi Akiva. He came before Rabbi Akiva, v'chayvod yiten lezeh 400 zuz, and he obligated him to pay 400 zuz to this woman. Now this guy clearly thinks that this woman is not of such a stature, or not a woman deserving of 400 zuz. Amar lo Rabbi, ten lizman, give me some time to pay it. Now, this is very interesting because in general, and the Rambam points this out, that when it comes to any other type of nezek, we do not give time to pay it. When there is damage or loss to the nizak, to the victimized party, we will not allow time for you to pay. You must pay it immediately to make restitution or compensation to the individual. The reason that Rabbi Akiva is willing to give him Zman over here is because it's bullshit. We're dealing with embarrassment. We deal with embarrassment. Embarrassment, it's a payment for an intangible item. There is no real loss here in terms of monetary loss. It's just compensation to make whole for the intangible item, the embarrassment that was caused over here. For that reason, Rabbi Akiva was willing to give him a little leniency in the payment and give him some time to make the payment because of the fact that we're not dealing with something which is a real loss that you're trying to make up for, but rather it's an assessed loss or the cost of embarrassment that the Chachamim assigned over here, so he gave him some time. Natan lo zman, shamra, omeret apeta chatzira. He, I don't know if he was stalking her, if he was watching her, but he found that she stood at the opening of her chatzer, or he waited till she was standing at the opening of her chatzer. She bare the kad bifaneha. He took a pitcher full of oil and broke it on the ground in front of her. Oboki isar shemen. And inside of it was like a coin's worth of shemen. Wasn't a large amount of shemen, a small amount of shemen. Vigiltat rosha. She uncovered her hair. Vaita mitapechet manchat yada rosha. Dipping her hand into the oil and putting it into her hair. That was a common practice in that day, to put oil in the hair in order to, whether it was to tame the hair, to make it look better, or to coif the hair somehow. She was putting this oil into her hair. But you see here that she willingly, of her own volition, uncovered her hair in order to get this small amount of oil. What's clear from the story is that this woman is someone who is not wealthy. This is a woman who, when given the opportunity to take some small amount of oil, rushed to that opportunity. Rushed in a manner that she wasn't even worried about her own kavod, and she uncovered her hair in order to do it. He put Edim there to witness the whole thing. Rabbi Akiva, and then comes Rabbi Akiva and he says, look, I can prove to you that this woman was not worthy of 400 zuz for my uncovering her hair. She uncovers her hair by herself. My uncovering her hair is not such a big deal. He goes, the mazik over here, who's the one who uncovered her hair, says, to this, I'm paying 400 zuz? Meaning that a woman who doesn't care about her own kavod, I have to pay 400 zuz? Amalei lo amart klum. Because he says to him, I don't care what you say, or you basically have said nothing, because this is Rabbi Akiva the Shita, though, that it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter what the actual stature of each individual is now. We have an objective standard that says everyone is equal in the face of the law, even with regards to subjective manners like bullshit. And therefore, this woman's going to get it, even though, as you're pointing out, she's really not worthy of this, because we treat everyone the same, and therefore you have to pay the 400 zuz. Hachovel be'atzmo, someone who injures himself, afo pi she'eino rashai, even though you do not have permission to do it, patur. You're not going to be chayav, we can't obligate you for the damage, but you are not allowed to do the damage. Acherim she'chav lubo, on the other hand, if it's third parties that damage him, chayavim, they are responsible, and they are chayavim if they do such damage to any individual. Again, the Gemara will discuss what exactly is being said in these cases, but what is clear to the Gemara is that you're not allowed to injure yourself, and despite that fact that you're not allowed to injure yourself, that still doesn't obligate you, or you're not chayav for anything if you do injure yourself, whereas when third parties do injure the individual, then they are chayavim. Bakotzeitz nitiotav, the similar idea by the case where someone who cuts down his saplings, afal pi she'enu rashai, even though you don't have permission or you don't have a right to cut down your saplings, you are patur. We're not going to obligate you. We're not going to fine you for that because there's a problem of baal tashchit. You are wasting productive trees or things that are going to produce in the future, and you're being baal tashchit. You're wiping them out, cutting them down, which is inappropriate. But achirim, if other people do that damage, they will be chayavin because there is damage here. There is a problem with what is being done. So here, your ownership of yourself, as well as your ownership of those saplings, gives you an exemption in terms of the monetary obligation. But with regards to the isur that applies, and it's a sur, or it's inappropriate for you to injure yourself, it's also problematic for you to violate baal tashchit and cutting down your own trees. Nevertheless, there's still not a monetary obligation. On the other hand, if it's a third party, not only is there an isur for them, there's also a monetary obligation that comes hand in hand with that. Ibailu, so this was your question in the Mishnah. Mane tsuri tnan o mane medina tnan. When the Mishnah says, mea mane, you ask me, what type of coinage is that? What is it? There it doesn't define it. The Gemara asks your question. It says, is that mane tsuri? Mane tsuri is the silver standard, as we'll call it. That is, the coins that were the larger silver standard coins. Or are we talking about the mane medina, which were the going coins of the time, which were those in circulation? And we know that the relationship between them is 8-1, which is that mane tsuri, the silver coins, are 8 times the size or 8 times the value of a coin that is of a mane medina. And so therefore, if you're talking about a mane tsuri, then chafet eislaim, 25 sela, would be worth kuf zuz, would be worth 100 zuz, because each sela is worth 4 zuz. So on the silver standard, every 25 Slaim would equal out to 100 zuz. And therefore, if you're talking about a mane of 100 zuz in mane tsuri, then you would be talking about 25 slaim. On the other hand, if you're talking about a mane medina, the sela medina is only worth half a zuz. And so then, if you're talking about half a zuz, then if you're talking about 100 zuz of the medina, you're talking about something 100 divided by 8, which is 12 and a half zuz tsuri. That's the question of the Gemara with regards to what was listed here in the Mishnah, and applies maybe to the other items in the Mishnah as well. We have the maneh here, we had mataim zuz, arba meot zuz, we had the sela. Which type of coinage are we speaking about here? Are we speaking about the sela tsuri, or are we speaking about the sela medina? Tashma, dau gavra, the takale the chavre, because we had a case here where this individual was tokeya the chavre, whatever the meaning of that is in the Mishnah, that's what he did here. After the kamei de Rabbi Yehuda Nisiyah, he came before Rabbi Yehuda Nisiyah and Amalei. So Rabbi Yehuda Nisiyah says to this individual, Ha'ana, Ha'Rabbi Yosef Aglili, I'm here, that's Rabbi Yosef Aglili, Havle Manetzuri, give him 100 zuz of Manetzuri. So Shma Mina, from here you can clearly conclude that Manetzuri Tnan Shma Mina. So we concluded, or we dealt at least with that issue, that the Mishnah when it says Maneh means Manetzuri, and the coinage that is being mentioned in our Mishnah is a manetzuri. If you remember, if we went back to the Gemara on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph, Gemara over there also asked the similar question. When we have numbers in the Mishnah, are those numbers in the coinage of tsuri or the coinage of medina? The Gemara's conclusion over there was, it depends. The coinage of the Torah is coinage al pi the manet tsuri, or al pi the coinage or mintage of tsuri, the silver standard. The coinage that is used in the Mishnah, and although unless otherwise stated, is the coinage of the Medina. Or, basically, there's a difference between Lashon Torah and Lashon Chachamim. Lashon HaTorah uses the Tzuri coinage system, and Lashon Chachamim, or the Mishnah, is using the Medina coinage system. The problem with that is that our Gemara just concludes just the opposite. Here we're talking about a Mishnah, and in the Mishnah, the Gemara is saying, here, going to be seen that it's Mane Tzuri, that we're talking about coinage that is the silver standard. This goes against the Gemara back on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph. How do you reconcile here between the Gemara back on Lamed Vav Amud Aleph and the Gemara over here? So over here, the Rishonim don't deal with it, but back on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph, that's where the Rishonim deal with it. Then if you look back there, the Balei HaTosafot say that it depends on what is written. That the Gemara back there on Daf Lamed Vav Amud Aleph was simply speaking about a Sela. That whenever the Mishnah uses the word Sela, that means Sela Medina. Whenever the Torah uses the term Sela or Shekel, that means Sela or Shekel Tzuri. And so that's the only thing that the Gemara meant over there back in Lamed Vav Amud Aleph. That is not a general statement about all coinage or all types of denominations. It's simply a comment about the word Sela. And so therefore over here, our Gemara is not talking about the word Sela, but rather it's speaking about Manet. And so therefore there'll be a different din or a different conclusion, which our Gemara has, which is that the Manet here in the Mishnah is a Manet Tzuri, even though the Sela then in our Mishnah would be a Sela Medina, according to that view of the Balei HaTosafot. Otherwise, you would have to suggest that we have a Machloket HaSugyot, and then you would have to reconcile between the Sugyot and determine which one is the normative Sugya, and determine whether when the Mishnah it's speaking about Tzuri or it's speaking about Medina, and say we have a Machloket between the two different Sugyot. Now the Gemara goes back and tries to understand the case that we brought. The Gemara knew what conclusion. The conclusion is that clear, Manan, our Mishnah is Manet Tzuri. But what was this cryptic statement that Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya made, where he says, it's me and Rabbi Yossi Aglili, and you gotta pay. So, my ha na hai Rabbi Yossi Aglili. What does that mean? Ilei ma'achi kamarlei. This is what he's saying to him. Ha na dechazitech. I saw you. Ha Rabbi Yossi Aglili damar manet suri. And Rabbi Yossi Aglili is of the opinion that the manet and the Mishnah is manet suri. Zil havle manet suri. Now go pay him the 100 sous that you owe him, the manet suri. Lememra, the aid na said dayan. From that, you would conclude that an aid, a witness, can become a dayan himself. So here, what you have is a case where Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya witnessed the event. He saw it himself. So he says, ha, no, I'm here, I saw what happened, and I'm going to paskin. That's number one. Number two is, Rabbi Yossi Aglili is of the opinion that the manet mishnah is a manet suri. Well, since I saw it, I'm paskining, and now I'm going to tell you what you owe is the 100 manet, or the 100 zuz, or the manet suri that was mentioned in the Mishnah. And that's what the statement of Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya means, but that brings you to a conclusion, which the Gemara notes over here, which is that when you're a witness, you can still be a judge on the case. The simplest way to read this is to say that this case here is a case where Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya saw it, and then he, as an individual, sat down and adjudicated the case, and he was the Dayan himself. So that's what it means, Eid Nasid Dayan. The other possibility is to explain the case here, that Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya didn't do this alone, rather he was a witness to the event, testified in front of the court about the event, and then sat down with the judges and also judged the case. And that's what it means over here, Eid Nased Dayan. So you can explain it either way. Again, the simpler way is just to explain that this is Dinei Mamonot, and Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya is adjudicating the case alone, and since he's adjudicating the case alone, he was the aid and he was also the Dayan. Now that means that Eid Nased Dayan, Vatanya, we have a brayta that says, Sanhedrin Shra'u Echad Sharaget HaNefesh, and Sanhedrin witnessed a murder. Miksatan nasu edim, miksatan nasu dayanim. According to Divrei Rabbi Tarfon says, then a portion of the Beit Din become the edim, and a portion of the Beit Din sit as dayanim in the case. Rabbi Kiva Omer, kulam edim heim. They all have to be witnesses. Ve'ein eid nased dayan. Since they were witnesses, they can no longer be the dayanim in the case. Gemara says, ad kan lo kama Rabbi Tarfon elo de miksatan nasu edim, miksatan nasu dayanim. Rabbi Tarfon, who is the more mekil, we'll call it, position over here, the one who allows a witness to be a dayan, he only said that a portion of the individuals are edim, and a portion of them are dayanim. About eid nase dayan lo kamar, he never says that anyone who's a witness can then sit as a judge in the case. Whether, again, as we explained before, that means that he testified and then sat down with the Beit Din, or that means that he himself was witness to the event, and then he sat down as a dayan in the case. But in either way, that's not what Rabbi Tarfon says. It's clear Rabbi Kiva doesn't allow that because he says, Ein, Eid Nased Dayan. But even Rabbi Tarfon allows it only allows it that if you were a witness, you could still be a dayan, but you could only act in one of the two positions. You can't act in both of the positions. You could either be an aid or a dayan. You cannot be both. Where it says, Kitanya ayi, that bright does speak about a case, kagon shirau balayla, the case where they witnessed the event at night. The lola meva dina ninhu, they can't adjudicate the case at that time. That statement of Rabbi Tarfon is made in a scenario in which the Beit Din witnessed the event at night. Since the court is already adjourned for the night, and you can't have Tchilat Adin, you can't start a case during the middle of the night, that means that the Dayanim, who witnessed the event, can't adjudicate based on that sighting. What they have to do now is come back tomorrow, when the Beit Din is sitting, and testify. If they're testifying, then they are Edim. And that's what the Gemara says over here. That is the case, or that is the scenario, where they part of them have to be Edim, and part of them have to be Dayanim. But if there was a case where they witnessed the event during the day, which means that they saw it, and then they sat down to adjudicate the case, they could adjudicate the case based on their witnessing of the event. As Bali Tosafot would say here, Imra'u b'yom din, b'yom danin al-piriyah, d'lotei shmiyah g'dola miriyah. How could it be that hearing about the event, hearsay, meaning through witnesses, is better than a situation in which you witnessed the event yourself? And so therefore, the Dayanim could sit down and then adjudicate the case based on what they saw. Diriyah, and so that's what it says, is kekabalat edut, citing or witnessing the event is the equivalent of accepting edim, and kekabalat edut ketchilat din, and accepting a witness is like the beginning of a case, and a case can only begin during the day. So that's why the bright over there says that in the next morning they have to testify as witnesses and not as Dayanim. But in our scenario over here, where Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya himself saw it, and it was during the daytime, he can adjudicate the case, because then he is a witness, but not a witness in the sense of coming to testify. He's a witness because he saw it, and he adjudicates based on that sighting right away. And it's the equivalent of hearing from Edim. V'bay Dema, Achi Kamarle. Some suggest that this is the alternative of what he said to him. Ha'ana, the sphere like Rabbi Yossi Aglili. I hold like Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Damar Manet Suri, who says that the payment in the Mishnah is based on the coinage or the mintage of Tzuri. And here, over here, I have another set of Edim that are testifying that you did this. So again, he's then not putting himself into the case, and it has nothing to do with Eid Nasid Dayan. Zilhavle Manet Tzuri. Go pay him the Manet Tzuri. And now the Gemara is going to go on to discuss Rabbi Kiva's position. So before we go on to Rabbi Kiva's position, the first thing to ask is, why is it that Ein Eid Nasid Dayan? Why can an Eid not be a Dayan? So the first possibility brought by the Bali Tosafot is based on the Pasuk. Right, so Tosafot brings the reason that you're mentioning, which is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, it says that they will adjudicate the case, judge the case, and they will look into the possibility that they could save him and bring a skut here. If they saw or witnessed the event, there's no way they're going to ever find anything that is beneficial or a merit for him. And so therefore, that is a preclusion of an aid becoming a dayan, because a dayan can never perform that side of it in silu aida. And then, Tosafot brings from the Rashbam that the reasoning is, Bishum dichtiv amdu shnei hanashim, says that the two people will stand, damrina bishvot elu aidim, lifnei Hashem, before God, elu adayanim. That the witnesses need to stand before the dayanim. But it can't be that the witnesses themselves are sitting down and being the dayanim. The pasuk seems to indicate that the edim and dayanim are separate positions in the case, but if the aid is a dayan, then you haven't separated between these two positions, and you can't have the edim standing before the dayanim, because the aid himself is the dayan. The re brings another tam. We learn it out from the dinim of inheritance that are passed down by Yom Chanchilo Dedav, that Hanchalat Ayom Shishamu Mibakrei Choleh, Shnatan Kol Echad Mibanav Yamidu Kol Echad Bechelko. That when people come to visit the sick individual, and he commands them, or instructs them what to give to each of his children, that is the paradigm of a situation or circumstance where we're going to adjudicate the case. That's only in a case where he tells them during the daytime, because then they can be the witnesses and the dayanim in the case. Avala pishma to belayla, if it was done at night, lo yamidu kol echad ve'echad. They couldn't do that. They couldn't adjudicate the case based on what they heard there. So he's using the word bayom hanchilo to tell you only during the daytime where they get that information, are they able then to divide up the property based on his instructions as Dayanim and quote-unquote Edim? But had it happened at night, that wouldn't work. The reason it wouldn't work is because Ein Eid not said Dayan. And so that's how the Re learned the source for it. The last possibility is brought by the Balei Tosfot. It says, Yesh mefashim mishum davalei edut she'en ata yechol azima. It's a testimony that cannot be undermined by Edim Zomamim. Came to Atzmo Eid vidayan, since he's both a witness and a Dayan, lo yikabel hazama l'atzmo. He won't accept other Edim coming and undermine his testimony as an aid. So, in a sense, he's an unimpeachable aid, because he is the Dayan now, and he can decide who can come and testify or undermine or perjure him in any sense. So therefore, since he's in control of the situation, he's protected as an aid far too much, and then the opposing Edim will not be able to bring case or testify against his position. The Balei Tosafot reject this, based on the Rimi Orleans saying that that's just not true. They could just go to another court. They could go to another court and say, this guy testified and was the Dayan in the case, and we know that he wasn't there, or he was with us on that day. And they can bring the Hazama can happen in a different court, and that court can then overrule this Dayan that is over there. So they think that that's not the sole reason. But there's a number of reasons as to why Ein Eid Nased Dayan. Now, in terms of the Eid Nased Dayan, the Balei Tosafot point out that there's a difference between the Shita of Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon. Number one is, Ein Eid Nased Dayan means that if the person acts as a witness in the case, he cannot be a Dayan in the case. But that does not mean that if just because he witnessed the event, that he cannot be a Dayan in the case. If your Eid saw something, but he's not testifying, he can be a Dayan, afilu b'dinei nefashot l'Rabbanan, even in the dinei nefashot, according to the Rabbanan. Udoloke Rashbam. And Tosafot says, my opinion here is not like what the Rashbam says. The Rashbam of Avatra says that if they intended to testify, even though they never in the end testify as Edim, they cannot be Dayanim, because Ein Eid Nased Dayan. Ula Rabbi Kiva, afilu Eid Ro'eh. That's the Shita of Rabbi Tarfon. When we say Ein Eid Nased Dayan, it's simply a separation between the two positions. That means that an aid can be an aid, but not a Dayan. A Dayan can be a Dayan, but not an aid. That doesn't mean that just because a Dayan witnessed the event, he can't be a Dayan. So according to Rabbi Tarfon, an aid can be a Dayan as long as he doesn't function as an aid in this court case. But even though he witnessed the event, he can't be. On the other hand, for Rabbi Akiva, if the aid witnessed the event, by definition, he's precluded from being a Dayan in this case because of the problem of Itzilu Aida, the problem that he will never see something meritorious for this individual. Therefore, if he witnessed the event, he can't be a Dayan, even if he's never an aid in the case. His simple witnessing of the event precludes him from being a Dayan. That is the Shita of Rabbi Akiva. But Rabbi Akiva's din, since he learns it out of Itzilu Aida, is uniquely applicable by Dinei Nefashot and not by Dinei Memononu. And that is that by Dinei Mamonot, there is no such rule as Ein Eid Nased Dayan. It's solely or uniquely applicable by Dinei Nefashot. And for the Chachamim in Dinei Mamonot, not only does an Eid Nased Dayan, like we see over here, I mean, if you witness the event by Dinei Nefashot, you can still be a Dayan as long as you don't act as an Eid. Then for them, by Dinei Mamonot, even if you witness the event and you testified as a witness, you can sit as an Dayan in the case, in cases of Dinei Mamonot. So that means that there's a difference between Dinei Nefashot and Dinei Mamonot in both opinions. Rabbi Kiva's opinion by Dinei Nefashot is that if you witness the event, you cannot be a Dayan. In Mamonot, if you witness the event, you can be a Dayan as long as you don't function as an aid in the case. On the other hand, for Rabbi Tarfon, in the case where it's Dinei Nefashot, you can be a Dayan as long as you never worked or functioned as an aid in the case. Even if you witness the event, you can still be a Dayan. And Dinei Mamonot, even if you functioned as an aid in the case, you can also sit as a Dayan in this case. What Rashi suggests over here is that Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya held like Rabbi Tarfon, and that Rabbi Tarfon says that in case of Dinei Mamonot, which is our case over here, where the Dayan himself witnessed the event, and he's going to be a Dayan in the case, that is fine. Because by Dinei Mamonot, Rabbi Tarfon says that Eid Nased Dayan, and that's even in a case where he testifies in the case, even if he is actually testifying in the case. As the Balei Tosafot point out later on, that even Rabbi Akiva could agree to that, and he thinks that Rashi is wrong in saying that this applies even just by Rabbi Tarfon, because even according to Rabbi Akiva, as we explained now, Eid Nased Dayan by Dinei Mamonot, as long as he doesn't testify in the case, he could be a Dayan in the case. So in a case where he witnesses it, and he does not have to testify in the case, I mean, it wasn't done at night, it was done during the day, then even Rabbi Akiva would agree that Eid Naseh Dayan, according to Rabbi Akiva, according to the Baalei Tosafot, and for that reason, the Baalei Tosafot think that Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya could either hold like either Rabbi Tarfon or Rabbi Akiva, because both of them agree that it was during the daytime, and the Dayan himself witnessed this Dinei Mimononot, he can then sit down and adjudicate the case based on what he saw. Because he's not acting as an aide. Since he's not acting as an aide for Rabbi Akiva, that clearly could be a Dayan. For Rabbi Tarfon, even if he was acting as an aide, he could be the Dayan over here, but that's not necessary because he witnessed it during the daytime. Right now, the Gemara questions this Shita with regards to Rabbi Akiva, and says, "Besav Rabbi Akiva, dein aide nase Dayan." Does Rabbi Akiva really believe that an aide cannot become a Dayan? Vatanya, we have a right of Vika ish et re'eu be'evin o be'grof. Individual hits his fellow Jew with a stone or with his fist. Shimon etaymani omer, my grof miuchad shimasur le'edau le'edim. Just like a fist is discoverable evidence that can be seen both by the witnesses as well as the judges in the case. Afko shimasur le'edau le'edim. So too, you can only adjudicate cases where the evidence is visible both to the edan le'edim. Prat, the exception that as shiatzta mitachad yad le'edim, that the edim saw the weapon that was used here, the stone that was used here, but they no longer could identify the stone for the judges to see the case. In that case, we can't adjudicate the case because the judges never get a sense of the size of the weapon as to whether that weapon was big enough or strong enough to do the damage or the killing, which was testified to by the Edim. So even though the Edim testify as to the size of the weapon and to what everything that happened, that's not sufficient according to Shimon HaTemani. Amar lo Akiva, v'chip b'fnei beitin hikau? What do you mean? You think the guy hit him right in front of beitin? Shiodim kama hikau? Do you know how hard he hit him? Ba'ma hikau, and exactly where he hit him? Imal shoko? Was it on his leg? Otzipar nafsho? Or was it on the, Rashi brings here, the soft tissue near the heart? Or the cartilage near the heart? Sounds like the diaphragm where he's hitting him. Others suggest that it's nafsho. Tzipar nafsho is where his heart beats, like tzipor, which means that he hit him on the heart, in a place which is fatal. Meaning that the only way that the Beit Din knows what happened is through the witnesses. The witnesses tell us where he hit him, how hard he hit him, then why does the Beit Din need to see the weapon? Why can't they rely on the witnesses to tell us what the size or the nature of the weapon was? Va'od, harishatachaf et chaviro mirosh agag. Someone pushed off his friend from a roof and killed him. Omirosha Bira, from the top of some sort of palatial estate. Umate, and he dies. Beitin Ochim Etzel Bira. Does Beitin go to visit the location of the murder? O Bira Olechet Etzel Beitin, or do they bring the house or the place to the Beitin? No. Again, this is just out of logic. We don't see Beitin doesn't go and just do discovery of the evidence at first hand. They rely on the witnesses to tell them what happened and exactly what the scenario is. Ve'od, and even more so, Nafla, Choseru Boneh. What happens if the house collapsed? We go rebuild it so they can see what the house looked like? Of course not. All of this is dependent on the witnesses. Elama egrof miuchad shu masur le'edim. So Rabbi Akiva learns, not like Shimon HaTemani, but rather, that just like a fist is something that can be seen by the edim, and the knowledge of the edim is sufficient, avko shu masur le'edim. So too, anything that has to do with the witnessing of the Edim, we will utilize that, and that will be sufficient evidence to prosecute the case. Prat, exception that has, shiatzta, evin mitachat yadosha makeh, patur. In a case where the person who did the damaging or the injury over here, if he had the rock, but then it disappeared before the Edim ever got sight of it or understood the size of it, then in that case, you cannot adjudicate the case, because the Edim can't testify to us that the weapon was large enough or sufficient size to do the damage that was done here. It has to do with the blow and not the weakness of the injured party. And that's what we're really trying to determine, is that was it a death blow or was it a strong enough blow to do the damage that came about here. So Rabbi Akiva says Edim are sufficient, but if you lack that witnessing of the weapon by the Edim, then that is not sufficient to prosecute the case. So now the Gemara says, Tani mihat. From this you would conclude, Amalo Rabbi Akiva, v'chi b'fnei beitin hiko? Shiodim kama hiko? Meaning, did this all happen in front of beitin, that they know exactly what happened? Ha hiko b'fneihem? The implications of that are, had he hit him in front of beitin, Eid Naseh Dayan, they would have been Eid Naseh Dayan, he wouldn't need Eidim at all. Meaning that the alternative to having witnesses come in and testify about it is what Rabbi Shimon HaTemani basically says, is that the Eidah, that the beitin sees it. So he says, what, the way they have to see the murder weapon or the weapon of damage, do they also have to see the event? And so the implication of that, if they did see the event, that would be sufficient. And then it would be, and I said, my answer is no problem. The Varav, the Rabbi Shimon, Hatemani, Kamar, Velelo, Svirle. Gave is just saying, according to you, Shimon Hatemani, who believes this, that you have to have the Beit Din involved, then do you say that the Beit Din themselves has to see it? But not that Rabbi Kiva would have believed that, or he agrees with that position, because even if they witness it, ain't Aid not said Dayan, according to Rabbi Kiva. So this isn't Rabbi Kiva the Shitato, this is Rabbi Kiva telling Shimon Hatemani the Shitatcha. I still don't understand what you're saying over here. You are saying that you need the Beit Din to see the murder weapon. Why do they have to see it? They don't have to see everything else in the case. And so all those other things that they would see in the case, until the point where Eid Nasadayan is all in Shimon HaTemani's Shita, so Rabbi Kiva using his logic, with Shimon HaTemani's logic, to undermine Shimon HaTemani's position. The Gemara says, Tanrabanan, Shortam Shemit Vezik. Shortam that both killed someone who makes him subject to a death penalty, Vezik, and it also damaged. Danino Todini Nefashot, we first bring the case where he killed the individual, and we forget about the case where he did monetary damage, because a short time only pays migufo, out of his body. And now that he's killed someone, and if we adjudicate the case against him, he's going to be usur b'hana'ah. He's going to be usur b'hana'ah because he's going to be subject to a death penalty. There's nothing from which to collect. The animal is worthless now. It's going on death row. If it's on death row, then you can't collect from the tam, the body of the tam. Then mu'ad she'mit v'zik, it's a case where it's a mu'ad, who both kills and damages. Danino to dinim emanot. We first adjudicate the monetary loss case. V'chozrim et danino to dinim nefashot. And then afterwards, we adjudicate the case where he killed someone and put him on death row. The reason being that by muad, you pay min ha'aliyah. Min ha'aliyah means that the owner is responsible. So what we do is we first make the owner responsible for the payment of the monetary damage that was done. And then afterwards, then the animal goes on death row, and then the animal is worthless. So, yes, in terms of the animal being worthless, you're right. But in terms of collection, since it's min aliyah, it's not the animal itself that is the object from which you collect. And that's the case. We can't adjudicate the damage case separately. So, kadmu v'danu adinei fashot. In the case of muad, if they jumped the gun and they tried him for the killing first, and now he's on death row, in chozim v'danu to dinei memanot, then you can't go back after the fact and adjudicate the case based on dinei memanot, because once the animal's on death row, he is no longer, I'll call it, under the balut, the ownership of the owner. He's been disowned from the owner because he came asur b'hana'ah. And at that point, we can't then bring him to task for the nezek that was done. Gemara says, v'chi kadmu v'danu dinei nefashot. I want to understand this. If they first adjudicated the case where the animal had killed someone, my avi, why is that a case sufficient enough to close the case? L'hadar v'li danei nami memonot. Go back now and adjudicate the memonot. If it's all about min aliyah, who cares that the animal's worthless? We still can adjudicate the monetary case as long as the animal's still here. Rabbi Kiva Eger has a hard time with this Gemara based on the Gemaras that we saw before, especially the Shitat Rashi, who believes that you need ownership over the animal in order to adjudicate the case. It seems clear here that the ownership of the individual, once you have been dan dinei nefashot, meaning that you have put the animal on death row, that the owner's ownership has been lifted or removed from the animal, in that case, then you couldn't be dan dinei memonot. And for that reason, Rabbi Kiva Eger questions why the Gemara thinks that for sure, after the case of dinei nefashot, you could bring the case of dinei memonot and still obligate the balim in this case. Rabbi Kiva Eger leaves it as a tzarech yin gadol. There are those that want to, acronym that want to suggest over here, that it's a case where the nizak grabbed the animal, and then you have balim of the animal over here, so you can adjudicate the case. Amar Rava, Ashkechitu l'Rabbanan de Beirav, I found the Rabbanan from the Beit Midrash, the Yatfe v'Ka'amre, that we're sitting there and saying, Hamani, who's the author of this position over here? It's Rabbi Shimon HaTeimanihi, who we just saw, Damar, my growth miyuchad shemasur le'idal edim, just like the fist is something that the edim see and witness, as well as can be brought in front of the Beit Din for them to see it, Alma be'inan umdana de Beidina. We need an assessment of the Beit Din of all the aspects of the case. They need to be able to see everything that is involved in the case. V'ha kevan d'gomar dina l'ktala, lo mishainan lay, lo umdana Beit Dina. Because over here, once the animal goes on death row, we don't hold him around, we don't keep him around in order to assess the value or to assess the damage that the animal did. For Beit Din then to assess the type of damage or the nature of the damage that he could do. V'lo ma'aninan l'dinei. Because there is inui hadin. Anyway, Din, which again is a concept that we mentioned before in Masechta with regards to humans, which is that we don't delay the punishment, the execution of the conclusion of a case when there's a capital crime or a death penalty, because we don't want the prisoner to suffer waiting for the actual execution to be carried out. The Gemara says the same thing applies by animals. That's once they're put on death row, you just got to kill them. You don't hang them, keep them hanging around for a long period of time. Since we're not going to keep them around, there's no opportunity, there's no time to do an umdana, to do an assessment of the situation based on the animal. If that's the case, you're lacking in the evidence required to prosecute the case, according to Rabbi Shimon HaTemani, who before said not only do you need witnesses, you need the Beit Din to see these items. So now the Beit Din can't see it because they can't keep the animal around. They got to take him out to execute it immediately. Vamina lohu. And so Rabbi says back to these Rabbanim from the Beit Midrash, Ana afilu tema Rabbi Akiva. I think that Rabbi Akiva can either be the author of this position. Hacha b'mayaskina, and what's the case here? Kagon shebarach. The owner ran away.
So therefore we understand why in the case where you did the din nefeshot already, we can't adjudicate the monetary case. But that leads to a separate problem, is then how do you explain the first scenario that was brought?
Where it says, Ibarach, if he ran away, kilo danu din nefeshot, hecha dininele din mimonot.
Oh, the case here is a case where the owner ran away at this point in time. Then in the original case, where they first adjudicated the monetary case, and then they didn't nefeshot, how do they adjudicate the monetary case if the Baalim are not there? If they're not present, you can't obligate them when they're not present. So in the other case, you're suggesting that they did the didn't nefeshot first. And now we can't adjudicate the monetary matter because the guy ran away.
Then in the original case, if he ran away, well, how can we have adjudicated the monetary case before they didn't nefeshot? Where it says, no, the Kabbal Sadeh Ubarach. Case where we accepted the witnesses with regards to the monetary case, and then the owner took off. In that case, they first adjudicated the case, and then he only took off. In our case here, he took off before we ever got to the monetary case, and that's why we can't adjudicate that matter. So the Gemara says, sof, meichem mishtalei. Okay, that works well in terms of setting up the case here, even according to Rabbi Akiva, which is that we have a case at first where we adjudicate the monetary case, and then the owner runs away, so now we can't bring the animal to the death penalty. And that's why you're getting paid out over here. But then who are you collecting payment from? The guy ran away. Or it says, Miridya. You actually allow the individual to utilize the animal, to plow with the animal, to get monetary return from the animal, to get compensated. And then he will, once he's finished with that compensation, then only then will we bring him on trial for the death case, if we can get the original owner back here to bring that case to court. Or it says, Yochi tam ni dini dinim monot. Bereisha. So let's do the same thing with that short time then. Let us adjudicate the monetary case first. Vinishtale miridya. And let the animal work, pay off the debt. V'adar nidayne dinin nefeshot. And then afterwards we'll adjudicate the case based on the death penalty. So Rav Mari, Breder Rav Kahana, Zoto Merit, Ridya Aliyah Demarahu. The plowing or the value created by the work of the animal is not out of the goof of the animal itself, but rather it is money that belongs to the owner. The difference being that a short time only pays me goofo. And so even though it's the goof of the animal producing the plowing and producing the work, that is still considered aliyah, not goofo. So for a short time, even if you produce that value, you can't collect out of it because it's not considered to be me goofo. Now then, by a short mu'ad, where you can't collect out of the aliyah, we allow you to generate that value of the aliyah, collect from that money, and then afterwards put him on death row, because then you get paid back for the dinim monot, and then you can put him on trial for the killing, and then you'll put him on death row and kill the animal after that fact. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Tzadi Aleph, Amud Aleph.